So with those reminders, I'm going to pull up the agenda for our session and turn the floor to your session moderator, Jeff Brewer from the Army Corps of Engineers. Jeff?
Thanks, Jean. Hey, I'd like to welcome everybody, or good morning or afternoon, depending on where you're at. My name is Jeff Brewer. I'm an Ordnance Exposed Safety Specialist with the Army Corps of Engineers Environmental Munitions Center of Expertise in Huntsville. We host these webinars about 3 times a year, once every quarter. And I'll be sending out some invites to some people. So if you get an invite for the next one, make sure you forward it to everybody you can. Keep an eye on CLEWIN's website for the upcoming one. The next one we'll be doing is the Best of SAGE and Second Munitions Response Meeting. It's on June 28th, and we'll be getting that announcement out probably within the next week or so. We've got some great presenters today. We got Ryan Steigerwald from Weston Solutions and a member of the National Association of Ordnance Contractors. We have John Jackson and Amanda Sticker from the Army Corps of Engineers, EMCX, and Jeff Swanson from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. Please don't hold that against him. But so we've got a really good presentations for today. We're going to be having you for the next 3 hours. We'll take breaks as needed. Just remember that any questions that you ask or plug into the Q&A box, we will be answering those questions at the end of their presentations. So be patient and we will get to those. And that's pretty much all I have right now. So what I'm going to do is go ahead and start up the first presentation, and that'll be Mr. Ryan Steigerwald. So, Gene, if you can plug him in, or Ryan.
Absolutely. So as Ryan comes up, we'll get Ryan's video on. I'll swap the view over to his video. And then, Ryan, if you want to share the screen, I'll give you a quick confirmation as soon as we have your slides up there. And your slides are up. Go ahead, Ryan.
All right. Great. Thank you, Jeff and Gene. Just to start a little bit of my background, I've been with Weston Solutions for about 20 years now. I've also been a volunteer for the National Association of Ordnance Contractors, or NEOC, for nearly the same amount of time. So I wanted to give, before I got started, I wanted to give a little plug on NEOC. Just so if you aren't familiar with the association, I want to give a little input, and then our website's at the bottom if you want to check that out, or you can always write me for additional information. But NEOC is a nonprofit organization focused on advancing munitions response services. We have 67 member companies. Most of them are small business, actually. And we collaborate to improve the industry. We engage with DoD on policy and regulatory solutions, as well as promote the MMRP, or Military Munitions Response Program, with lawmakers within Congress. And there's number of networking events every year. Most recently, we had our annual meeting in December, and I think there were nearly 200 participants on that, from DoD, federal and state regulators and industry. So again, check our website out, or get with me for additional information if you need it. A little bit of the history or motivation of this presentation. This all started last year when USACE approached NEOC about suggestions on how to improve their performance work statements, or PWSs. And apparently, I missed that meeting because I got tasked with this presentation. So, lesson learned there, but now you're stuck with me for about an hour. But so again, this is probably a year in the making, but after some initial discussions with member companies, I realized a lot of the comments weren't just on the PWS. Comments were on the, all inclusive of the request for proposal process, or RFP process. And topic did get a lot of traction. We got a lot of input from NEOC, because really the cost of sales are a significant part of any business, and reducing cost of sales, or having the ability to do more with cost of sales by either standardizing or streamlining the RFP process would benefit anybody working in this space. So, from the association perspective, we also, just because of the diversity of our membership, we need to be mindful that we need to be able to differentiate ourselves in our own way, but at the same time, reduce risk due to uncertainty. And, that risk could be risking overhead dollars, as an example, or overhead dollars on project performance. So getting into it a little bit, what we ended up doing was soliciting all our members and receiving that input. We compiled and assessed it. And while we were doing that, really three groups emerged. And the first group being the RFP process and communications. And this really involves the interaction between the government and contractors, such as the transmittals connected to the RFP, the Q&A, the GFI. The second group is the RFP and PWS content, so things like instructions to offerors, PWS tasks, and other requirements. And then there were also a number of miscellaneous items that I didn't want to ignore. So I did put those at the end of this presentation. I'm not sure we'll have time to get through all of those, but I just want to keep those in there for reference and future dialogue. So, I think the important thing is we really want to make this as interactive as possible. So please provide your input and ask questions along the way. There's a couple breaks I have built into the presentation. So we'll be monitoring chat, like Jeff and Gene said, and then hopefully you won't just hear me, but maybe Amanda, JJ, and Jeff will weigh in along the way as well. For your reference, we try to put in a big page number, a header with the topic, and then blue text occasionally that hopefully will spur or trigger your input. And hopefully we can connect that all in the chat as we move along here. So make sure we have time for Q&A. I'll just hop right into it. The first topic that really had come up with the input from our NEOC membership is that we noted that several contracting groups maintain and provide a list of possible projects throughout the fiscal year. And some groups might send one out at the beginning. Some groups might update it quarterly or as needed. And what we found is that list is extremely helpful to our membership and contractors in general. And we certainly understand why there's some hesitation to not do this by some groups. But I think we understand that that there is some uncertainty with it. Nothing is set until the ink's dry. But I think if we did get lists more regularly or from additional groups, it allows us to prioritize our internal resources and maybe be more selective or really focus on key opportunities that might impact our respective companies. So I think the point is, if possible, if you are in a contracting position, just maybe updating contractors more regularly on new starts, upcoming opportunities, what contracts the opportunities are coming from. It would really help, I think, with gaining or instituting more competition and allow contractors to position much better than we would without it. The second topic is receiving draft or preliminary draft PWSs. And again, this has been found to be extremely helpful as well. And again, it really encourages competition. And we hope this will become more common practice in the future. Allows us to jump on making early strategic decisions about the opportunity itself, or even start assessing a technical approach for the opportunity if it is a priority for an individual company. And then having some information about the project even before the site visit would allow us to get a little bit more prepared. And this could be a timing issue, but often feedback or questions on draft PWSs aren't always requested. And I think what the comments that I received were saying is, if this would occur, we could potentially mitigate Q&A when the RFP is released and that clock starts ticking for the actual proposal. So, I think the purpose of this slide is really we really like draft and preliminary draft PWSs early. And then if he could consider potentially accepting Q&A on those, I think that would be helpful in the long run. We've also noted a few instances where the potential adequacy of the RFP isn't there. And, you know, I'm first to admit, even when looking at the comments that I received, well, you know, contractors have the same problem. Everybody's busy. We get behind schedule for one reason or another. A technical review isn't completed. And, you know, when this happens with an RFP, there are more questions that are asked during the RFP process, and it can complicate the proposal response. So, you know, we would just, you know, several contractors brought this up. We would just recommend maybe just doing a technical review of the entire RFP package before it's released to the contracting pool. There's several comments that we received on questions and answers, and a lot of good feedback on this particular topic. But what we've seen is the response time from the government to answer questions can vary after an RFP is released. And, you know, especially if we happen to get an RFP over the holidays, it can vary quite a bit. But while questions are being considered by the government, the contractor still needs to continue with proposal preparation to meet the originally established proposal due dates. And, you know, I personally can't imagine having to answer 100 questions on Progenet. So I completely understand it. It's got to be time consuming. But it would be helpful if the contractors could get periodic updates throughout the RFP process on status or just generally when answers might be provided. So we can sort of lay out our proposal schedule a little bit better and refine it and understand the government's schedule on your end. Also, on questions and answers, on occasion, we will receive answers to questions, and the answers might spur additional questions. And there's often no ability to ask follow-up questions on complex projects, or when time allows, we would suggest potentially two rounds of questions and answers, or just the final chance to ask clarifying questions to the answers provided. So that would be helpful. A lot of times, Progenet might close down and you can't ask more, or there really isn't a clear way to maybe go back and get clarifying questions. So having that option would be certainly helpful. And I think most of the comments were on larger complex projects where this might be more beneficial than others. You also find similar questions are asked for every RFP. The questions that are consistently repeated could be good ones to consider for including in the PWS template or other parts of the RFP. And one suggestion was for the government to do a potential programmatic review of Q&A and incorporate into the PWS some of the basic assumptions anticipated for each site. And, you know, I think the thought process was to potentially just cut back on just frequently asked questions by contractors, because I think there's a lot of the same things like accessibility to the site, vehicular access, and some other things that I think we could, or there could be a potential to, you know, just mitigate general questions that we see often. On, the next topic is government furnished information, or GFI, and GFI was part of a lot of member companies' feedback. And I know some of this is not completely connected to the RIFS, PWS, or RFPs, but the general consensus would be to request all GFI provided at the same time of the RFP, or as far in advance as possible. And not being provided all GFI at one time can create challenges for the contractors and ultimately favor the incumbent contractor if there is one. And also having GFI before the site visit can help with planning the right personnel or equipment needs if the site is accessible on a site visit. Now, receiving GFI early can also impact our proposals, especially the technical approach. However, delays in receiving key information can also cause rework for or the need to perform additional internal management reviews. And, you know, a contractor did send me an example of where they had to drop an opportunity because certain pieces of the GFI weren't provided timely. They were just unable to, you know, once they got it, they were unable to recover and put an adequate response together. So definitely the importance of GFI can't be understated. And you know, also the timing of the proposal due date is sometimes not adjusted based on last GFI received. And in particular, where you have large sites or a lot of GFI, can take a long time to transfer that. And sometimes it's transferred over the course of a period of time. So, you know, we ask that consideration be given to the due date extension if GFI is provided late. And, you know, I think the consensus is from everything I've seen, worksheets 10 and 11 are extremely helpful, and it's appreciated getting that early so we can plan and prepare. Some of the worksheets are certainly well thought out, and others can be more on the generic side. And, you know, I think based on the comments that I receive, it's kind of half and half, but really I think what the feedback is, certainly the more detailed, the better. Some things noted by the membership and companies include inconsistency with how visual sample plan inputs and calculations are provided. Sometimes they're missing assumptions or not provided at all, or any background going into those calculations. So all that would be helpful. The critical pieces of the project would be helpful in those worksheets. And then also meeting minutes or other information from planning sessions with regulators are not consistently provided or performed. Providing these notes, in particular from regulators, helps contractors with understanding expectations. The next topic is on site visits. So the comments that I received for site visits, the number of people allowed on site visits can be sometimes limiting, especially if subcontractors are required or the site is large and complex. And, you know, understandable that, you know, we can't be sending 20 people out there. So there's got to be reasonable limits. So, but, you know, we asked them maybe just take a look at that just based on the type of site and the challenges. And also sometimes from the comments that I received that the types of individuals expected to be on site visits are not defined in the RFP or the notice of the site visit. And for example, you know, some USACE districts might send an OESS and they might serve as a safety officer and escort for site visit attendees. And then other times we find out the contractor may need a UXO technician for escort and also have somebody that has CPR first aid calls. And you know, all this is fine, but sometimes I guess the message is, from what I've seen, it's not, our membership is saying it's not really consistent throughout. And we understand that there's going to be differences for every project, but making that a little bit more clear in the site visit notice or the RFP would certainly be helpful for planning purposes. And we would also like to suggest potentially, depending on the project again, but if there was an ability for stakeholders to attend, like regulators, or have a separate part of the site visit to hold more dialogue on worksheets 10 and 11, would certainly be helpful. And I know that, sometimes this is hampered by the fact that the government is reluctant to answer questions on the site visit, which is understandable. But I think not being able to have that dialogue and understand stakeholder regulatory perspectives diminishes the success of the site visit. So some comments, hopefully we can follow up there on site visits. The next couple slides are on RFP response periods. And, recently we've been finding that response periods for task order proposals and even IDIQ proposals require an extension. And this can be due to Q&A delays, resolutions of inconsistencies in the RFP package, and or I guess the need for gathering additional or missing GFI. And certainly it is appreciated when additional time is allotted when needed, but we've noticed that an extension to the proposal due date is typically known relatively early in the RFP process. And more often than not, the extensions are granted towards the end of the original response period and sometimes only a day or two before the proposal is due. And it certainly, hampers the proposal preparation process for contractors. And the suggestion is if an extension is known to be needed, it would be really helpful if that was acknowledged and just communicated that, there will be an extension forthcoming. Or, one contractor said, well, why don't you just do the extension? But so even just that communication aspect of, it, just acknowledging it and the contractor can understand that there is going to be an extension and we can plan around that would certainly be helpful. And again, I mentioned this before, but there are several suggestions that extensions to the proposal schedule have some connectivity to the last answers to questions or the last GFI distributed. So there is adequate time to digest those, incorporate those into the proposal. And a lot of times, often if there is some lead information received, sometimes contractors have already gone through management reviews and we have to redo those reviews in some cases, and which can be time consuming and just another step that we would like to circumvent. So those are, I did put a little bit of a break here for any current comments or questions or feedback at this point, so we can maybe recap on the previous topics.
All right. Ryan, just chiming in here as I wait to hear from Jeff. But there are some questions. Jeff, did you find one or two you want to ask now?
All righty. Let's see what we got here. And let me get my video back up. There we go. All right, Ryan, here we go. Let's see. Can you provide examples of GIFs? And never heard that term before. Do you mean site data?
Can you say it one more time, Jeff? I'm sorry.
Okay. Can you provide examples of GIF? Never heard of that term before. Do you mean site data?
Gotcha. Yeah. GFI is government furnished information. So it could be anything from reports from previous studies, GIS information, just general information about the site that would help the contractor or help the contractor team put the proposal together. So it's really many times it's historical information about the site that feeds into the technical approach and cost estimate. And the sooner we get that, and sometimes it's, sometimes it's maybe just two reports. Sometimes it could be several hundred documents for a particular site, depending on size and complexity. So the sooner you get that, the more time you have to incorporate it.
All right. Next question. We got three more questions here. So do you have an example of a performance work statement you can share?
Yeah, and maybe I'll ask that of Amanda and John, because I know there's there's certainly a template, and I think you guys are taking a look at another template and maybe a revision.
All right. The next one is, have you given this presentation to contract staff, contracting officers? We as technical contract staff reps, CORs, WAMs, would love what you are asking for, but these decisions are made way above our level in the contracting shop by the management.
Yeah, no, good feedback. And we started with a pretty technical group last year, and a lot of great feedback. We didn't even get through the presentation. We're trying this, get a little bit of a bigger audience, so hopefully we can certainly work our way up to some of the decision makers, and hopefully this can get out and promote some dialogue around it. But good feedback on that.
All right. What about data formats and Exchange storage? We spend so much time consolidating and processing site data in different formats and store in different places. Share with us online different ways. I've often wondered if it would be better to prescribe this in advance in an RFP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another good point. And I can see that on both sides. I know for a fact we're generating so much data on some of our projects now. And just understanding how we should be, or how the government envisions us packaging that up on the back end, would be helpful. But also in advance of, or as part of the RFP, there's sometimes so much information, and DoD Safe is used sometimes, but sometimes that just, there's so much information, it's not effective. And sometimes the easiest solution is just to transmit a hard drive around. But data is always going to be, at least here in the near term, always going to be a challenge.
All right. That was the last question.
Great. Good feedback. Thank you. This, we get into the next main section of content, and the first topic is format instructions. So getting into the comments that I received on this topic suggest that the proposal instructions require a lot of interpretation and follow-on questions. And things like proposal page count is sometimes limited, especially if the project is complex or there are multiple sites. It was suggested by several companies that the government consider a consistent presentation of format instructions, and so that the requirements are a little bit more clear and have less interpretation. And some further suggestions suggest maybe just a simple tabular format that provides the basic things that like page count, or things that are excluded or included, and just in a succinct way. And then things could be added to that table or revised based on unique site conditions or the requirements of the RFP. But just having a consistent presentation in the same place in the RFP would generally be helpful for the contractors. And probably one of the bigger topics too was under RFP instructions was generally the basis of award statement consistency. And typically the basis of award is consistent. It's usually best value trade-off or best value approach. And then we see a description of what that means. And where it starts getting confusing is the extra instructions or the combination of basis of award instructions and evaluation criteria. And sometimes they end up being contradictory, But often just because there are just so many layers of instructions, evaluation criteria, and other things that it just gets really confusing. And I'll just walk through some of these things. And, you know, certainly I don't expect you to read these, but I just have them in here for reference, and I'm not going to read them either. But, you know, this is kind of like the basic award description. It describes best value trade-off and what factors are more important for the reviewer. And, you know, this is, you know, generally just really concise and easy to follow. And now we have another example where it sort of says the same thing as example one, but it goes into a little bit more detail and same general content, but it reiterates several times and several different ways that the award will not be made to necessarily be made to the lowest price offer and some other things. So, it, you know, adding additional information doesn't always make it better in some cases. And then where it gets more complicated is when additional instructions or evaluation criteria are then added to the basis award statement. So this example is the more basic evaluation criteria or instructions we see. It requests just the fundamentals, who, what, and how. It requests information on assumptions and risks. And, you know, it's pretty clear cut. And then we get into another version in this example of where it's very specific, but it is to the point. It lists seven criteria that will be evaluated. So it might go from, you know, geophysical requirements to the what engineering manual you need to comply with. But it's certainly completely different than the previous, but it is specific and detailed in its own right. And then the next example is very detailed, and but at the same time, it's slightly, I guess the way the comments came in, the way I'm interpreting it, it's slightly random too. And so this goes through a bunch of things that are going to be evaluated, and not in any particular order necessarily, but just a lot of things. And it's actually several pages long. So this is the first page. Then it goes into even more criteria on top of the other criteria. In this case, you know, it starts getting really confusing on what they're asking for and what we need to put in our proposal to meet the criteria. And then sometimes it's actually further complicated. And this is, I'm still going on the same criteria instructions, but then there's even sometimes even more evaluation criteria added. And this is where there's information on how you get a strength or weakness on top of the other evaluation criteria, instructions, and basis of award. And a lot of information. Like I said, I didn't want to read it all. I just want to put it in here for reference. But to really just kind of summarize, I think what the comments I received were, it gets pretty blurry in what criteria reviewers are actually going to use for the contractor selection. Instructions don't always follow succinctly the PWS tasks or the sequential steps of the project progression. And you know, certainly this can make proposal writing even harder than it typically is. The technical people on a proposal team want to follow the PWS, and then the proposal people, the proposal managers, want to follow the instructions and evaluation criteria. So depending on how the RFP is set up, that what you need to follow, how you want to follow it, how you want to present it can be really confusing and lead to actually internal debates on what best to do. The NEOC membership have suggested to just maybe take a look at that and make the RFP instructions and evaluation criteria less complicated and possibly even more in line with the PWS format, and also clearly explain how the basis of award and instructions and evaluation criteria will be evaluated or assessed. So a lot of back and forth with NEOC member companies on that. But I think just to really boil it down, I think there could be opportunity where, you know, we could potentially work together and just figure out how to make the evaluation criteria instructions a little bit more succinct, less complex, and easier to respond to. Jeff and Gene, I did put another quick break in here if there were more additional questions.
No questions this time. Press on. Doing a great job.
All right. The next topic is on PWS details or performance work statement details, and the level of detail between, as an example, just looking at USACE districts and also other government agencies, the level of detail can vary between being really prescriptive in the PWS to just really reiterating the PWS template. We're not using the PWS template at all. And detail in particular key assumptions in the PWS can be helpful unless there are discrepancies like not matching worksheets 10 or 11, or the details and assumptions in the PWS are not binding. And two companies, I believe, sent me this just one example. And, essentially the performance work statement stated that geophysical transects needed to be 50 feet apart to meet VSP criteria based on 20 millimeter projectile. So that was in the PWS. And then a contractor asked the government to please confirm 50 foot transect spacing is the requirement. And the government responded by saying, well, it's a performance-based contract. So, things like that, if there are specific things in the PWS, it's sometimes a challenge for contractors to understand if that's truly a requirement or if it's loose and it does come down to a PBA, performance-based acquisition type scenario where, we could do something else. So I think just maybe unpacking that a little bit is just, I think there's got to be some consistency on how the PWS is used, what kind of level of detail, and how that detail is then leveraged in the contractor's proposals. A couple things on use of AGC, and we're certainly with the PWS, new PWS template, we're seeing this statement, to the maximum extent practical, conduct a field investigation by gathering AGC data. And we have also seen something like this, where it says, describe the geophysical coverage approach which maximizes use of AGC. And the wording is slightly different, and it's not clear on how this is being reviewed for contractor selection. So, we just want to make sure that, whatever the language is, that there is a consistent thinking on the government side on what this actually means. And it's sometimes, I think from some of the Q&A I've personally seen, there's sometimes a little bit of debate on, what this actually means, how it's actually being evaluated, and if somebody used some other technology and it might be acceptable to one district and not acceptable to another, it gets a little confusing. Next topic is fixed unit pricing, and really and any other methods as well for pricing, but there's a concern with firm fixed price when the type, quantity, and location of work is predicated upon outcomes of another work activity yet to be completed. And some of the examples I have in the presentation includes things like biological and cultural resource requirements, ROEs. I believe at least the last PWS template I saw, rights of entry were always kind of envisioned to be cost plus fixed fee, but a lot of times it comes out for a fixed price. Then you also have the characterization of HD areas, requirements for surface clearance, surface sweeps, or MEC avoidance. And walk you through a couple examples of, you know, where contracting methods or fixed unit prices might become beneficial. And, you know, one example was provided to me from a member firm. And in this example, a species protocol survey task was required by the PWS, and contractors requested a list of species to assume because the level of effort can vary significantly based on species, and species are unknown at the time of the proposal. The government, in turn, responded to that question and just stated that species for protocol surveys will be determined by the outcome of the biological survey. And you know, further clarification was requested about the biological monitoring. The response was requirement for biological monitoring during field work will be determined by the outcome of the biological surveys. So in this case, there are some unknown requirements, in particular for biological surveys, that the contractor has to speculate on, make assumptions on, and it might be more beneficial to do some sort of fixed unit pricing or some other alternative method in these cases to, you know, avoid maybe overly conservative or contractor assumptions, or you know, putting a government in a situation where they're taking on risk. Another example is example two, where biological or cultural resource escorts may be needed in some or all locations or no locations at the site. The specific requirement is based on the preliminary surveys that are required to be performed. So in this case, the contractor is required to assume what may be needed in their proposal or costs, which may or may not be consistent with another contractor, or the assumptions made by the government in this case. So, you know, I think there's opportunity here to also look at an alternative method where there aren't a whole bunch of assumptions that need to be made for the proposal, and the ultimate outcome of the execution of the work may be completely different. The last example is on, you know, high density areas. So the number and location of high density areas and potential high use areas is often unknown until the preliminary characterization survey is complete. And your questions are being asked by contractors to define number of HD areas, and the government response indicates it is really up to the contractor to determine. But so having some potential fixed unit price structure for doing something that is currently unknown during the proposal process could be helpful to mitigate risk on both sides. And I know getting a little short on time here, I want to leave a couple minutes on for Q&A, but, you know, a lot of times I think almost, I would say almost half the contractors that provided input to me cited these FAR clauses on, you know, why firm fixed price on some of this work is probably not suitable. And it's just here for reference. I know there's a lot of dialogue that goes into this, a lot of perspectives, but certainly it's, you know, something that the contractors certainly have provided as fodder to push for our alternative methods instead of just firm fixed price lump sum. Could there be some alternatives? And I know that some of that dialogue is currently happening now. You know, certainly, like you said, there is more a notable increase in fixed unit prices, but however, they're just not consistently applied yet. And you know, it's not clear how assumptions that we're putting into our proposals are being reviewed by the government as part of the selection process, and in particular when assumptions between contractors are significantly different because of just unknowns, like the biological cultural survey examples. And, you know, if the assumption is wrong and we win the contract, how's that being handled from a contracting perspective? From a regulatory involvement perspective, a bunch of comments on it. I mentioned, you know, potentially involving stakeholders, regulators during the site visit, but, you know, certainly being able to capture regulatory and stakeholder expectations and review times as part of the PWS, or at least part of the partnering sessions that occur leading up to worksheet and 1011 and preparation would be helpful in understanding that as part of the RFP. And then, you know, defining how regulators and stakeholders factor into the work and product reviews, approvals, and getting concurrence or courtesy reviews, just having more definition around that would certainly be helpful. And then I'm going to go through these again pretty quickly here just to save a little bit of time, but there's a list of deliverables in the PWS that often isn't consistent with the work that's being performed. And it's really, sometimes it's just not tailored. We're also, several comments said that sometimes it's impossible to meet the period of performance based on the review durations and all the documents that are required as part of the RFP. So it might be just something that we need to take a closer look at. And then just doing a closer review of the table before it gets sent out to take out just the extraneous things that might not be necessarily as for the proposal. And, you know, sometimes we asked about that in question form, and the response we get back is, well, the table is just the guideline. And so just, again, understanding if it's in the PWS, how rigid is following the PWS versus not. Risk is, you know, certainly on everybody's radar and a critical piece of any pursuit. And sometimes the requirements are very prescriptive in RFPs, and it provides a lot of expectations and requirements and what needs to be in there. Sometimes it's not. So having maybe a little bit more clarity on how the government reviews risk and how they want to see that on specific RFPs would be helpful. There's also a requirement for a backup DADCAP accredited firm. Sometimes that's not clear, and it, depending on who you're working with, they may need to see a teaming agreement. Other times, acknowledgement of that fact is fine, and just more clarity on expectations there would also be certainly helpful. And Gene and Jeff, I'll break there. The last slide is just some of those general things that I mentioned, and you know, maybe we can pick up on those some other time.
All right, Ryan. Great job. Actually, we just got a second question, and we only had one statement. It's actually wasn't even a question. But the first one was, these are really helpful examples of performance work statement language. Thank you for including these. So that was an attaboy from an anonymous attendee. We've got another question. I don't know if this is true for all agencies, but at ours, we're right the RFP, PWSs, then we get proposals, and then we come up with the proposal review criteria. We don't do the criteria when writing the performance work statements. It can be painful to try to figure out all these methods to evaluate.
Hmm. Interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yep, and we got another one here. Do you use project risk registers?
Hmm. Yeah, you know, typically they're... when we see an RFP, there typically is a risk section required. And I think how that risk section is articulated is dependent on the contractor, but many times the instructions in RFP allude to having a risk register of sorts and some sort of table. Sometimes it's pretty prescriptive what the table might look like or the contents of it. But typically from what I understand, what I understand from other contractors too, a risk register of sorts is often put into the proposal. The level of detail, the size of it all varies, I think, depending on the complexity of the project, but also space allotted, and then also the requirements of RFP.
Perfect. That's all the questions we have. You've got about less than 2 minutes left.
Yeah, I mean, that's all I have. Certainly, like you said, I think if you do have other input, I'd love to hear it. We want to, I think NEOC in general wants to keep the dialogue going on some of these things. So we'll keep adding to it. I have some work to do on some of these general, I call it general or miscellaneous topics, but I think there's some more to do there, and hopefully we can continue this dialogue and at various levels of the government as well.
Perfect. All right. Well, then we'll press on. Our next presenters is John Jackson, one of the CEX's foremost geophysicists, and we got Amanda Sticker also. And Amanda has her fingers in about everything we do over there, so it's kind of hard to narrow it down. So I will turn it over to you two, and have at it.
That is so funny, Jeff. I don't have my fingers on everything just yet.
Give it time.
No, but what an amazing introduction, Ryan. So thank you so much for all that background. As you can tell, you know, we are constantly growing and just value that feedback so much. Of course, you know, we've got a lot of participants on the call listening to you. So, you know, if you are ever interested, we would love to have you present this to our contracting group. Wouldn't you agree, John Jackson? I think it'd be awesome for him to share all that stuff. But I am sharing my screen. I know somebody asked about the PWS earlier. So what you're looking at right there, John Jackson, I'm assuming that you all can see the memo. Is that correct?
We can. Amanda, you might zoom in just a tiny bit, but we can see it.
Oh, it's not for attention, just kind of an overview. But that is the memo that Laura Beasley signed a few years back. We are working on updates for the RIFS. But then, as you can see, here's kind of just the RIFS template that I am revising currently. You can tell it goes through each CLIN, which is a contract line item number. But it's tried to be broken down. As Ryan showed us, you know, we can do a better job, and we are working on outlining some of these metrics a whole lot better. But without further ado, let me go back to my front screen. John Jackson and I are going to be presenting from the government's perspective, but just looking at it, I'm going to briefly touch on, you know, the USACE programmatic business process. So I want to give you, it's not just for MMRP, but how does USACE conduct their business overall? And then we're going to work on the systematic planning process, look at sessions 1 and 2, which happened before award. We'll look at the QAP worksheets 9, 10, 11, and then talk about the discussions prior to solicitation. We'll take a quick break because I know everybody needs a break. But then we'll turn it over to John Jackson. He will talk about geophysical sensor data, making sure that we provide that clear audit trail. And then going into SPP to awarding the contract. And then we'll briefly touch on lessons learned throughout.
Amanda, real quick, we still see the PDF file. You might need to swap the sharing method.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry. Thank you so much.
That's okay.
All right, let's stop sharing. Mm-hmm. Let me reboot it. Thanks for that, Gina. I appreciate that.
No problem.
All right, let's try it again. I'm going to do window. And then let's do that. How are we now?
All right. It looks like it is coming up. And I've got your operating principle, business process imperative slides up full screen. Thank you.
Perfect. Thanks, Jean. Appreciate that. But there's our agenda. I'll go back one screen. There we go. looking at the USACE principles for business process, you know, it is all outlined in the ER 5111, which, you know, we govern by five operating principles for all of our work, to include MMRP performed by USACE. And these are, you know, first and foremost, plan for success and keep our commitments, right? And, you know, as we are moving towards, you know, better quality, Ryan pointing out some of those things in that first presentation. Again, great job, Ryan. Thank you so much. But we want to measure that quality with goals and expectations with customer in mind. And then communications. We want to build that effective communication into all activities and processes. You know, that includes with our contractors, with our regulators, and with our stakeholders. And then, of course, with our customers. And then best practices, we want to make sure that we are continually improving and then use that automated information systems consistently and accurately. What does that look like on the MMRP side? You know, we have BudsMiss that we do. We have administrative record files. We have on, you know, the AEC and National Guard side for right now, we use HQAES. So making sure we consistently update all of those records. And then we have the GIS. On the business process, there are three complementary imperatives that govern the successful completion of projects. And what does that look like? You know, first and foremost, we've got one project, one team, one project manager. You know, that's kind of how we structure all of our stuff. Now, if you're looking from the core side, we always call it the PDT, right? The project delivery team. And then with every one of our projects, we manage it on a hierarchy with the PMP, the project management plan. You know, we do that for the customer side, but then for each project, we also have it. And then the PDC is responsible for project success. This is handed all the way down from USACE leadership, you know. They say that the heart of our business process is results-focused teamwork, and they give it to the PDT to make sure that we successfully manage that project. Looking again, teasing apart that imperative number one, you know, the one project, one team, one project manager, we want to make sure that everyone is invited to the table that's necessary for the development and execution of that phase of the project, right? So, you know, all your stakeholders are an integral part, but just making sure you have the right people on your team sitting at the table, you know, your technical staff, your project engineers, your regulators, your support staff, you know, they all form the consensus of our PDT. And whether we're looking at the business process of a PMP or we're looking at a project PMP, you know, we're going to develop and maintain that PMP throughout the project, right? Throughout the life cycle of it. We want to make sure that we've got our stakeholders involved with it. And then we want to make sure that it's signed by all of our PDT members to include our stakeholders. It is a living document. So as, you know, we learn new things, we might need to get it updated. But it is scalable, and it's going to be our roadmap for our project delivery. You know, it's going to outline our PDT, our scope of work, or what we call our performance work statement. It's going to have our budget in there as well as our schedule, and just the level of detail. And then the PDT, again, responsible for project success. You know, all of those things feed into one another. We do take ownership of it. You know, we are empowered to make these decisions of the project. And the key is understanding when to escalate some of these things that might affect the project delivery, right? Teamwork is key success. You know, my overall objective in all of this stuff, you know, John Jackson will talk about the field work and the geophysics of it, but mine is going to be communication. Communication is so vital to our projects. And I know everybody has seen the triangle of a project diagram, right? Whether you're in construction work, whether you're in MMRP or HTRW, you've got, you know, the overall triangle of scope, schedule, and budget, right? But then if we look at the outer side of it, you know, USACE business culture and values, we really want to emphasize safety being first, as well as quality and service. And then at the integral part of all of this are our resources, right? That includes you all, which is our PDT, you know, people to include USACE, contractors, our regulators, and our stakeholders. And there's a lot of people involved to make sure that these projects are executed accordingly. So looking at one project, one team, and I'm going to call on some names right here just to give you an example. So let's say that Mark Leeper calls up Chris Evans and says, hey, I've got a project right here. Chris Evans calls John Jackson and I, and he says, hey, guys, we have this project. We need you all to execute this accordingly for Mark. You know, John Jackson and I are going to call up Jeff. You know, he's going to be the regulator on this project. And we're going to say, okay, what do we got going on? How can we execute this for Mark? Because we want to make sure that we are identifying and preventing any data gaps right from the start of the project, right? And how do we do that? It's going to take one block at a time, right? So we're looking at our USACE project delivery members. We need to make sure we've got our chemist involved, our GIS, our technical team, with our geophysicist, our technical manager, whoever's involved on the project to make sure we've got it outlined correctly. We want to have our regulator at the team, our government furnished information. And I know there was a question on that, but that includes everything that was done up until that point, any kind of document, any kind of deliverable. So think about your historical records review report. If there was a site inspection done, if there was an archive search report done, that all feeds into that government furnished information that we want to share. And then as we're working on it, we want to make sure that we are working and developing worksheets 10 and 11, outlining that conceptual site model and our DQOs, our data quality objectives. We are working with Jeff Swanson to write out all of our opinions and thoughts on worksheets 9. We've developed that into our PWS, our performance work statement. We've issued that request for proposal. We have our question and answers that we've gone through and done due diligence. You know, maybe we need to revise a PWS along the way. We've gathered our source selection evaluation board. And so we can come back and say, hey, Chris, you know, we're awarding the contract now. But, you know, it all starts with the systematic planning process. And what that does is it, you know, it brings everybody to the table and helps us form that weight of evidence approach based on multiple lines of evidence in our conceptual site model. You know, we're looking at the relevance, the strength, the reliability of all of our data and making sure that, you know, we're making informed decisions and it's going to be defensible. You know, there's nothing worse than looking in one phase and then looking back and saying, you know, did we do this? Do we have any data gaps? And what do we need to do now? So this systematic planning process is very, very vital, setting up the project correct before you ever award, as well as throughout the process. And this is going to be a sneak peek. We are working on getting the newest EM200-115, the revised, published very soon. It is up at leadership right now, but I'm going to give you all a sneak peek on what you all can look forward to. We've heard the concerns. We've taken those. We've made updates on it. But this newest EM200-115, it provides the systematic planning process activity overview, all outlined in a table. But for each step, it's going to give you inputs, activities, and outputs, and it identifies all your participants needed. So without further ado, let me show you a behind-the-scenes look on what's coming next. So let me turn on my little laser pointer to kind of give you some reference. So you'll see up at the top right here, we've got a few different phases outlined, but for this one right here, you can see this is through the final MEC remedial action report. You've got your project phase right here, and then our activity, our generalized PMP activity. We're going to focus on this pre-award project planning as well as, you know, awarding the RFP. Doing the RFP evaluation and awarding the contract. This is where we're going to stay at for right now, but it's also outlined all the way to the final report. And then we're going to look at planning sessions 1 and 2. And then here's your participants outlined, your inputs, your activities, and your output. inputs. And so looking at the pre-award and planning sessions one and two, you know, we're going to focus on, and whoops, excuse me, I'm trying to blow it up. There we go. We're looking at, we're taking all of that GFI that we talked about. So we want any kind of remedial investigation report, the feasibility study, the ROD, the archive search report, any of that kind of stuff, right? We're gathering all of that stuff and we are sharing that to look at, you know, worksheets 10. We want to have, after that planning session one, we want to develop that worksheets 10 and 11. And then at session two, you know, we're going to have the output from session one to feed into that DQ, the worksheets 11, where we outline the data quality objectives. And then we're also going to look at, you know, getting that draft PWS, our evaluation criteria, having that IGE and our QASP outline. So really good details that we've outlined for the USA side, for the stakeholder side, you know, to include our regulators. But, you know, this does not happen just on the USA side alone. We want our regulators involved with this, just making sure we set the project up correctly. And then here's your breakdown of your participants. So at the very bottom of the table, and I'm sorry I couldn't show you all this because it was way too small. But, you know, it says at the top, our lead is our regulators, right? And so looking at that a little bit more, you know, we've got our project manager, our, you know, our CORs, our technical managers, anybody that we need to identify. But you can tell right here, you know, it is important for us to have our regulators involved and bring them to the table before we ever award the contract. And then we make sure that we're documenting all of that stuff on our worksheets nine, each and every time. All right, our workflow, just looking at, you know, like I mentioned, we're going to try to do worksheets 10 and 11 before the RFP. Documented in worksheet nine. And a big thing too, we want to do a site visit before we ever award the contract or invite the contractors out to the pre-proposal site visit. But we want our stakeholders and our USACE team out on the site looking at it just to make sure we have a very well-defined PWS. And then last but not least, you know, all of those outputs help us prepare the award and award the contract. How do we do all of this stuff? Where do we get this information? It all starts with the UFP QAP. And I know we have a lot of experienced people, but I know there were about 20% who, you know, kind of just started. But module one outlines for the RIFS. Module two, hopefully coming soon, is for our remedial actions. But in these documents, our black text is the minimum recommended requirements. Our blue text provides examples. And then the green gives us some really good examples. So if you're new and you haven't looked at those, check those out. Really easy to walk through on that. So I'm going to give you an example. James Salisbury came up with this. So it's really great. So let's say that we are going on vacation and John Jackson and I, we're going to go on vacation with our spouses and we say, okay, let's go. And so all we do is we pack a bag and we go to the airport. We never booked an airline ticket. We never really scheduled where we were going. All we did was pack some clothes in a suitcase, and that was about as far as we got. So we're hoping, you know, with that assumption, you know, we said we're going to go on vacation. We got to the airport, right? But number one, did we pack the right clothes? Number two, you know, what happens if the airplane, you know, that flight's full? Or, you know, what happens when we get to wherever we decide we're going to last minute? What happens if the hotels are full or, you know, there's no rental cars? So before you ever start any kind of project, you know, it's always important that you're asking a few questions and planning this, right? So some key questions we want to ask is, what do we really know about the site? And what's the end result of this phase? You know, at the site inspections, you know, we're looking at presence and absence. If we're looking, you know, at the RI, you know, what is the true nature and extent? Do we truly have all of that stuff? And to answer any of these questions, we are going to start, you know, with the conceptual site model in worksheet 10 and our data quality objectives in worksheet 11. And I love this little diagram saying, you know, if you don't know where you want to go, how are you going to know that you got there? Right? Pretty basic. Our data quality objectives is what tells us when our project's done, or more specifically, when we have the right type, or if we have sufficient quantity or even adequate quality. It'll help us to confirm that the conceptual site model and demonstrate the selected remedy has been implemented. DQOs have to be measurable. And then as it's tied hand in hand, you know, if our CSM changes, our DQOs need to change too. And how does the DQO process flow? Data quality objective. Number one, we're going to state the problem. You know, do we have mech in the area that could that's a risk to who? Do we have small arms ammunition? Do we have a potential leaching into groundwater? You know, we want to really tease apart that step one by stating the problem. And then number two, we need the decision to be made. We're going to identify all that. And then that feeds back into stating the problem. They're all intertwined. Step three, identify the inputs needed to make those decisions. You know, what data do you really need to answer those questions? And I love how in the CQAB, it really outlines that in the green text, as I talked about, you know, well, what about information needed to establish a presence or absence of mech to characterize potential hazard? Or how about to establish a potential exposure? So really good information inputs. Again, it's it has to feed up to that decisions that you're making. And then step four, you're defining your study boundaries. And then 5 through 7, you're looking at your technical approach. How are we supposed to use this data? What are the standards for our data usability, and how do we collect that data? Because at the end of the day, the data needs and our limitations that we define drive the approach that we get. So if we have faulty problems right here, then we're going to have a faulty project to start with. Looking at that worksheets 10, the conceptual site model, I have to say kudos to all of our contractors. We are doing a much better job on these conceptual site model pictures when we are getting them in our QAPs and then in our deliverables. These vertical profiles right here, where we're talking about land depth use, as well as how far each munition's going and what we've found, as well as a detailed figure. And then just having that figure right there, you know, says 1,000 words and really relays the content of what we're doing. Because this is our conceptual site model, right? It might consistently change throughout the project and we're updating this. But this really helps everybody understand on the same sheet of music, you know. And then the tables right here, your site details, your distribution of mech, your known and suspected munitions right here, especially your exposure medium. If we don't have any of these outlined correctly, if we're missing those, once we get to our feasibility study and we're looking at our alternatives, or even, you know, as we're completing our RI report, you know, our risk could be off based on these. And then we're developing wrong alternatives. And then last but not least on this chart right here, our exposure pathways. So we're looking for that current understanding of the site, right? Looking for your mech and your munition constituents, the areas that they're located. What are your terrain considerations? Are there going to be limitations on people getting equipment through? Or, you know, are they going to have to think outside the box on it? Are there access restrictions? You know, and it, whether it's in tables, maps, figures, graphics, you know, but the more that we can talk about it and better clearly outline it, the better, because it really helps us in developing those DQOs. And by the time that we get to the remedial action stage, hopefully, you know, we've got a very robust CSM that, you know, doesn't change at that point. The worksheets 10 are elements. We're looking at facility profile, whether it's site location, our size and ownership, the identifications and munitions and hazards. We're looking for that concise summary of relevant findings from previous investigations. So we really want to know, you know, what all has been done up until this point, your ROE status. Our physical profile to include accessibility, topography, and vegetation. Again, this is really going to help us, guys, you know, regardless of what phase you're in, on just how we define it to begin with to set it up for the contractors. Because if we have a lot of vegetation or if we're limited on any of those things, we're going to help steer the contractors on their approach and limit or decrease their assumptions. We're looking at geologic, hydrologic settings, our climate, endangered species, as Ryan brought up. You can tell why that is so important. The sensitive habitats and cultural resources. And if there's any areas that are or might be inaccessible. And then I will, I've got two more slides and then we're going to take a 10-minute break. But the release profile, we're looking at location and distribution of munitions and hazardous substances. What is our horizontal distribution? But more importantly, you know, what's our vertical distribution too? Is there an affected environmental media? What are anomaly densities? You know, we need to define those. And are we using the right equipment to define those to where we can get a handle on it? What are the boundaries of those? And then the areas being released by selected remedy, our land use and exposure profile, the current land uses, neighboring land uses, and all of our access conditions. Why do I go over all of these things? Because it is so important, guys, for us to outline all of these in our worksheets 9 in that summary. And we encourage our regulators, you know, in our USAFEs, encourage your regulators to have them in our sessions 1 and 2, just so that we can go over all of those. Because the more that we can define them right away, the better we can write our PWS and outline those things and decrease assumptions that we're putting on our contractors. So at each planning session, we're talking about the meeting purpose, dates, locations. We're taking the attendance, the roles, and the contact information. Typically, we would document that in some kind of table, like right here. But we're also documenting those consensus decisions made, any action items that we need to outline, and then the regulator and stakeholder concerns. Guys, we are capturing all of these now. I know this was probably before the start of COVID, but we, as USACE, decided we need to do a better job with this. So we are doing worksheets 10 and 11 before we issue the award. And we should be capturing all of this stuff in worksheet 9 to make sure that we share that with our government furnished information to our contractors. All right, Jeff, this is a good stopping point for us. Do we have any questions that we need to go over, sir?
I have 6 questions for you.
Wow.
All right. Let's get started real quick. Can the project team be identified in the performance work statement? Knowing which persons are involved will allow contractors to bid accurately.
I don't think that that's possible. Just, you know, they might be a part of the team, but we're not supposed to be releasing anything that could also be source selection evaluation board sensitive.
All right. Have you or does the UFP? Oh, somebody else jumped in another question here. Sorry. Actually, let's see here. Can the project team, wait a minute. There we go. Okay, now we're back. Sorry. Have you or does the UFP QAP involve developing a site strategy or agency? Oh, I'm sorry. Have you or does the UFP QAP involve developing a site strategy? Our agency has been heavily pushing a site strategy development to be prepared before we get into contracting.
Tell me that question one more time. I don't know that I'm understanding the question right away.
All right. Have you or does the UFP QAP involve developing a site strategy? Our agency, this thing keeps bouncing around on me. Sorry about that. Our agency has been heavily pushing a site strategy document to be prepared before we get into contracting.
Okay, so I'm going to make a few assumptions. Like, what we should be doing is USACE PDT should be working with our regulators as soon as we've found out that we have a project. You know, I use the example of Mark talking to Chris Evans contacting John Jackson and I and saying, hey, we've got a project. So at that point, John Jackson and I are putting together our team within USACE. We're calling up Jeff Swanson as a regulator and we're saying, hey guys, we're having SPP meetings 1 and 2, which develop worksheets 10 and 11. So I'm not sure that that answers the question, or maybe I don't understand the question, but yes, we should be working on those kind of outputs before we ever release the contract, Jeff. And then those kind of things, doing worksheets 10 and 11 help us develop the PWS.
All right. Next one. Actually, I had a couple more jump in here. So worksheets 10 and 11. Now they just jumped another one in there. Oh, goodness. I think we'll start the bottom here because there's times we type. It moves my screen. I can't even read the question. If not already asked, how can CX involvement be made consistent? Delayed CX comments causes rework, even though the contractors request CX early involvement. Not all districts will do so.
How can we be consistent? We're trying to be consistent. So, you know, I'll work with the leads and see what we can do a little bit better, but we are trying.
All right. Let's see. Where in this process is public awareness considered? For example, if a MMRP site is directly adjacent to an elementary school.
So public involvement starts right after the site inspection. If we've identified that there is a risk, you know, moving towards the remedial investigation, USACE is contacting, you know, people, you know, we're sharing that kind of information. Of course, you know, when we're doing our ROEs to gain access to certain areas, we're sharing those fact sheets, you know, we're getting stakeholder involvement there. And then when we're developing our MRSPPs, our Munitions Response Site Prioritization Protocol worksheets, we're also engaging with our stakeholders on that too. So it is continuous, you know, at the start that we have identified that we do have presence after the SI, and then it's a continuous process throughout.
Okay. Amanda, good presentation with one exception to the members in the PDT. Per ER 1110-1-8153, there is a technical lead and a COR. This is defined by the OE Design Center Chief as the person that used to be the OE DC PM. To clarify the district PM versus the OE DC PM, the technical lead name was developed in USACE. The team leader, the TL role is court, the team leader's role is coordinates all munition response related technical activities in support of the PM and PDT with a focus on safety, quality, and acquisition, and should be included in your discussions.
Absolutely. That's a great point. You know, to start with, it was a USACE overall and not just MMRP, but you're right. You know, the person driving all of our projects, you know, it's not just the PM. It's truly what we call the COR, our contracting office representative, and the technical lead. So great point.
All right. Why develop a vertical conceptual site model for specific munitions during the RI if the removal action simply states remove all mech in depth of instrument detection? Yes, contractors are seeing this type of language in PWSs.
That is a fabulous question. And I am going to put that to John Jackson. I can answer that for you, but I will tell you he has a better answer for that. So John Jackson, you are up, sir. Tag, you're it. Is John even on?
He is there, but I think he may have been pulled off to something else.
No, absolutely. So, yes, I can cover that. Why are we doing munitions, vertical munitions during the RI? Because these are going to help us on our land use as we go through all of our risk assessments and our alternatives. You know, it is based on our profiles, right? But then we also have to take into account what are removing in the rod. You know, how are we truly going to tease that language apart? Because we do have a better language that we're using. Gracious, Jeff, I hear you typing like crazy. but yeah, it's very important for us to do a vertical profile. And it's not that we don't have it already, right? We've already gathered that information. So it's good for us to have it.
All right, sorry. JJ did get kicked off.
That's okay.
According to
hopefully, yeah, I answered the question for you.
Okay, last question here. Worksheets 10 and 11 included with the performance work statements are often taking necessary details, boilerplate, and lacking site specific details. Some SPP meetings at 1 and 2 minutes identify meetings less than an hour in duration. Incorrect conceptual site models and bipolar plate DQOs adversely impact the project. As you say, it's provided training or emphasis on the importance of proper SPP meetings 1 and 2.
Yes, I totally agree. If we don't do an adequate job on worksheets 10 and 11 and, you know, we're lacking detail, you know, it does hurt us. And that's why I'm stressing this, you know, help us regulators, help USACE members, help us write better worksheets 10 and 11 to begin with. But then we are providing training consistently, but that is a starting point for you all, you know, on contractor side. So if you see that we need more robust, worksheets 10 and 11, when you get the project, absolutely take it and run with it. So, John Jackson, are you back on, sir?
I think I am now calling into phone.
No, that's fine. So, I wanted to pass you a question because I answered it, but I know you're going to have a much more sophisticated answer. So, there was a question that was brought up to our attention, like, why is a vertical profile of a munition important during the RI phase?
That is a good question and a good segue to a later slide. We'll actually be talking about that a little bit. But the vertical CSM isn't just limited to munitions and detection depth. You're also getting an idea of land use, contamination depth, and all of that's in relation to the depth of detection for munitions as well. So we want to gather all of that information, the RI, document it, make informed decisions on that. That would feed into the risk assessment. Then ultimately, whatever you do through the feasibility study and proposed plan, that final rod is going to document the decisions being made. And in some cases, you want to be very specific on what is the risk for each munition with depth and what are we going to do about it.
Very similar.
All right. Well, that was the last question we got. We're still going to take that 10 minutes.
Yeah, Jane, are you good with us taking 10 minutes right now? We can decrease if we need to.
I think if you guys are confident, what if we split the difference and we do 8 minutes? So if that is okay with everybody, we'll take a brief 8-minute break. I'm going to put a timer up on the screen here for the audience, and I'll just let everybody know during that brief break, I will have, as I said, a timer here on the screen. You'll hear silence over that 8-minute break, but we will resume. You can remain connected during the break. And again, we will resume our session here in approximately 8 minutes. So thank you all, but there'll be silence during the break. We'll get started here shortly. All right. I'll just remind everyone we are coming back from our brief break here. So you should see that timer counting down. If you are back and are ready to get started, you can feel free to send me a message in the Q&A in Zoom. Just let me know that you're back at your computer or device and are ready to get going. So again, click that Q&A button and you can feel free to send a message in through Q&A. All messages submitted are only visible to myself and the organizers. As I'm waiting for a couple of additional confirmation messages from the audience to come in here, I'm going to pull down my slides and let Amanda resume her presentation. And as Amanda gets her slides back up, I'll just continue to remind everybody we are ready to carry on with the session. I see lots of messages that you all are back and some of you are very excited and are ready to go. So Amanda, if you want to call up those slides, we can carry on with our second presentation here of the day. And it looks like they're back up. So carry on.
I gotcha. So John Jackson, without further ado, sir, you are up starting us out with lessons learned.
Excellent. Okay. Sorry about that, as my internet dropped at home. If I had known you were going to use a vacation analogy earlier, I would have forewarned you that I spent most of my 20s just packing a bag and a one-way ticket. So maybe that explains some of Ryan's complaints about our PWSs. But definitely a fun way to travel. Giving James Salisbury credit again, he has a way of explaining how some of our PWSs are. Would you just ask for a car, or would you say, I need something with four-wheel drive, I need something that can go 0 to 60 in a certain amount of time, what color car? So all of those are good, and we really should be offering some of those details in our PWSs as well. We can't just say complete RI, can't just say complete RA. We need to offer some of these discussions, and that's exactly what the pre-planning process is with the regulator, is we need to get on the same page. And to give credit to another attendee, Jordan Adelson has a way of saying it. If you guys aren't on the same page prior to award, what makes you think you'll be on the same page as after award? So If the outcome is you don't make that award, maybe it's been a successful pre-SPP process and we can regroup and try again at a later date. But I think beyond all of that is, over the last 40 years of attempting to do cleanup, we've had some guidance changes. And over the last 8 years, I would argue any one year, we've probably had more changes than we had in the prior 30. We've had AGC QAP, MRQAP Toolkit 1, MRQAP Toolkit 2 is on the way. We've had multiple iterations of 200-1-15. We've had improvements in technology. We've had that silly DAGCAP program come on board. And it's all changing the way we do work. And it's moving so fast, our contracting processes aren't keeping up. In fact, sometimes not even the information's getting to the right technical people. So I think taking that pause in the pre-SPP process is to make sure we're all on the same page for that. On top of that, we are just now moving from focusing on remedial investigations to some of those projects graduating to remedial action now. And at the time, we designed our remedial investigations for nature and extent and what we thought the data gaps might be and what the concerns for nature and extent might be. As we've now transitioned to remedial actions, we realized we weren't necessarily collecting all the information we might need for a successfully implemented remedial action or even a solid cost estimate. So I think having those discussions, making sure we're interpreting what the selected remedy might be prior to contract award is always a good thing. Next slide, please, Amanda. So we use those first two meetings to lay out, and I heard Ryan say earlier that, you know, a couple of the notes they've seen that the meeting was only an hour long. I'd be interested in the details behind some of that. I think there are some sites that are relatively straightforward. The project team has worked together for many years, and maybe that is all that's needed. But if it didn't provide a good worksheet 10 and 11, then obviously that wasn't all that was needed. So maybe they should have discussed some of these other issues we're about to talk about a little bit more. But hopefully if you've got a solid RI, a really successful FS, a lot of these stakeholder concerns, a lot of the site concerns have already been documented and they've already been outlined. So Hopefully we can put out a really good draft worksheet 10 and 11, which leads, we understand, I'm sympathetic to some of the concerns that Ryan presented. We know that contractors aren't psychic. We know we need to get more detailed information. I would love for you to know who's on a source selection, because everybody does have a different concern. We're all trying to meet that selected remedy or that RI goal, but everyone's human, and we're trying. We focus on what we got burned on last time, obviously. So there is a human element to that. But I think with a properly laid out PWS and worksheet 10 and 11, and good evaluation criteria, at least we'll see a little more consistency on that. Next slide, please. Did it go to the next slide, Amanda? Not on my screen.
I'm working on it, JJ. My computer just froze too, clearly.
We are not doing well on the computer side today.
And I do not have my VPN on, Gene, so it's not so, that. There we go.
We got there it. We go. Okay. And I'll call him up here as a backup just in case it happens again.
Thanks.
So what are some of these lessons learned? I think we've gotten the message out in different avenues, so none of these really should be a surprise, but it's really been the last couple of years in doing the SPP process that has allowed us to realize the impact of some of these issues. So one of them is, were our remedial investigation density estimates accurate? Were they good enough to be the basis of an accurate cost estimate? So we're realizing some of those limitations. One that's not quite as discussed, but it is starting to be now, is what are our anomaly reduction assumptions. So here I'm going to talk about saturated response areas, but that could apply to just your general classification. We go from 100,000 anomalies, and then we're going to dynamically do ISS, get down to 50,000, and then 90% from there. Is that your final dig number? So that some of those assumptions, I think we should be stacking hands on and laying out what they might be between 10 and 11 and the PWS. I'll talk about depth of classification considerations in a few slides, so I won't spend much time there. But then the big one, we're seeing this time and time again, are what are our coverage exclusions? So you might hear that as accessibility or inaccessibility, more importantly. Where can we not implement the remedy, the physical portion of the remedy? There might be areas, no matter how small they are on your site, that you cannot get an instrument there or anything. So you should be having those discussions, or there might be huge pockets. So that pre-government visit only with the stakeholder, let's look at some of those things and start documenting. Maybe it's appropriate to use some LIDAR, some airborne photography to help you do those things, but sometimes you got to get boots on the ground and out what those accessibility issues really are. I'll spend a little time talking about analog and then a little more time talking about items of concern as well. So in addition to that, we have safety considerations. Are there new nearby structures, residences? Are you going to implement the newly approved flexible minimum separation distances? Those conversations should be had at that stage. What about biological and cultural resources? I can't tell you the number of times we'll put a task in there for bio support, and we'll see somebody made the assumption that means a biologist spends one day on the site. Somebody makes the assumption maybe it's an initial 3 weeks on site to map out some of the general concerns, and then somebody else makes an assumption that every dig team needs that biological escort along with all the other escorts that might be needed. So if the government and the regulator can and the stakeholders can get on the same side prior to that RFP release, let's just spell that out. What are the requirements for this site? That way everybody's bidding. Back and forth over the last decade or so on the usefulness of that document. As I stand right now, I don't really see a purpose for it when we've got such a nicely put together QAP. I mean, everything in the QAP should be, we've got the responsible parties, we see who's supposed to verify it. So what really is the purpose of the QASP? Well, we still need to, it's still a contracting document. We still need to attach that to our RFP when we turn it in the contracting officers. So what can you glean from there? I think what pushes that discussion is there something that the contractor needs to provide to the government to assist in quality assurance? So something that immediately pops out is maybe we need to borrow a piece of equipment to perform quality assurance. If that's the case, let's specify who, when, and that gets highlighted. The procedures get highlighted in the CLASP, and then it becomes a PWS requirement. So I think that's one of the things that we really need to focus on for the CLASP. But other than that, we've got a brilliantly laid out 12, 22, and even some of the later worksheets like 29 through 33, they start to spell out what we really should be doing from a surveillance standpoint. Next slide, please, Amanda, hopefully.
You should see it, John. It's showing on my screen. I know you're glitching for a little bit. Jane, can you see the new slide?
I see a slide that is titled Military Munitions Response Program Policy with the FUD's guidance on the bottom. So, JJ, what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop your video just to help cut down on your bandwidth here, and hopefully you see her slide.
Can you hear me clearly again?
We can. I'll let you know if we need you to pick up the phone, okay?
Excellent. Thank you. So just two general guidance references that we've seen before, but we've got the DIRT manual stating that we have to have a digital record, and it's part of the administrative record. And then it states what we should be doing when analog is used. We also have a more FUD-specific policy that came out. I think that was mentioned earlier as well for the Karen Baker memo, but AGC is the preferred methodology. Non-AGC can be used when followed by AGC. And then for site-specific cases where the PDT determines use of AGC is not feasible or practical within a given MRS, the specific reasons shall be clearly documented in the administrative record for the MMRP project. So we're going to come back to that, but before we come back to these statements, I do want to highlight some case studies. So Amanda, if you can go to the next slide. Now we're cooking on my internet. That came through immediately. So I will continue to use this as an example. I think it's a brilliant example of what can be done. So first, this is a situation where maybe the RI anomaly density estimates didn't line up with what we're seeing in the remedial action. So the RI may have underestimated the number of anomalies in this area. Well, don't worry. Dynamic One Pass AGC came to save the day. We have 609 detections in this area, but only 17 TOI. So that's good. We're only digging. That's quite a reduction in clutter. So we're happy about that. But then the angle I really like about that, all those data gaps, all that white space on the left versus what's colored in on the right, we actually, using SLAM as part of that system, we have this LIDAR point cloud of where the trees actually are on this site. So we can use that as part of the land use controls. We can work with the landowner to say, hey, these are the footprints we were unable to get our instrument. And that can be part of the forest management process. On top of that, what this really highlights also was a successful second attempt at a pre-SPP, which is, you know, when you hear vegetation removal, you might hear clear-cut forest. And that is what this particular landowner was hearing at the time. They were hearing we were going to come in and remove the entire forest. But that's not the case. We came up with a good idea of number of trees per acre, what is the diameter of those trees that need to be left behind, and all of that can get documented and included in the PWS. So I really thought that was pretty successful and highlights a successful SPP process. Next slide, please, Amanda. So as promised, saturated response areas, it's become the bane of my existence recently, but this is areas where geophysical methods cannot discern individual sources. So in the EM61 world, it means we can't pick individual targets to go dig. In the AGC world, it might mean we can't pick individual locations to go queue or one pass. We can't classify those. So depending on the technology and some of the other site-specific issues, saturated response areas could be defined differently for different sites. So we need to get smarter and start having those discussions. Obviously, for a lot of the RIs becoming RAs now, that was not done. So I do see a tool of remedial design helping to answer some of those questions. But the government really should be dictating with concurrence from the regulator, what is a saturated response area? And I think they sort of fall into two categories of site. One, where we have a really dense target center. It's very obvious. Maybe we need to come in and do something there first before we follow up with AGC. So we do have a couple examples of sites that are going that path. And then we have the Swiss cheese type of site where we don't know where they are, but we know we're going to have small pockets of saturated response area. If that's the situation we're in, I see that we're going to have to change our contracting methodology. We can't just do a firm fixed price one task for that. We are probably going to have some base tasks mixed with some option tasks for how to handle those saturated response areas. Thank you for clicking forward. So the previous image was an EM61. That site would have been SRA in its entirety. For this particular area, we followed up with UltraTEM. So this is one pass UltraTEM image, and the saturated response area was reduced quite a bit. So definitely a conversation to be had as part of the pre-SPP. Next slide, Amanda. So here's some issues we're really just getting smart on now. This was a question earlier that I really liked. So why are we listing individual MEC or items of concern? Well, we need to know what our responsibilities within the selected remedy to remove so that we are achieving that acceptable risk. And it could mean wildly different things for different sites. Maybe one site we really are concerned about those 100-pound bombs down to 7 feet because of construction, while another site, it's really just those hand grenades in the top 6 inches. So all of those things, hopefully in our new RIFS model, we're spelling those out a little bit clearer. It's getting documented in the rod. But then ultimately, the rod's going to say something. So it may just be we've explicitly stated that MEC is, we know they're being left behind deeper than we can reliably detect or deeper than we need to go to. I mean, maybe the land use is only surface and we're relying on land use controls and that particular land use to not go into the subsurface. So that's good from a contracting standpoint. That means we stop at X. But what about the classification errors? Well, we need to start to get a little smarter on what our discussion is. How does the ability to resolve that depth and that position of that item, how is that reflected? So those errors need to be incorporated into the dig processes. If you can predict 12 inches plus or minus 6 inches, then you really should be including anything on the TOI list 18 inches and shallower, right? You can't just stop at 12. On top of that, we have the fun physics game of we're doing center of mass, but a lot of times our dig teams are looking at the plane of that subsurface. So did that item cross into the 12 inches below ground surface plane? So again, those discussions, if they weren't part of the planning process, certainly should be after contract award. But ideally, again, pre. And then what about targets of interest that are classified deeper than X? Hopefully, when we are in a situation where we think they're few and far between, we are digging them as the default. We now know they're there, so let's go after them. But there might be exceptions. So if that's the case, that needs to be spelled out in the contract. So those are some of my lessons learned that we've come up with on the last few years on contracts awarded. Next slide, Amanda. So going back to analog, we talked about the additionally, so we do want to go digital whenever possible. In In addition to that, we have SLAM, which is allowing a more efficient use of technology within vegetation where GPS can't be used. But the take-home message here, hopefully, is use of analog geophysical methods for supporting project decisions must be justified and approved. So we have a lot of policy out there to tell us when and how to do that. But next slide, please, Amanda. Let's talk about when we think analog is permissible. So anomaly avoidance, nothing stopping you from doing it then. Instrument assisted anomaly reduction or surface sweep prior to DGM. MAG and DEG and SRAs to reduce number of anomalies. Both of those are fine. We're following up with DGM or AGC, so that's not the final methodologies for making that decision or meeting that selected remedy. Investigation of targets of interest. So dig teams that want to use that as a tool to help them with the digging procedures, absolutely A-OK. A little bit more of a hand-wavy one, but limited fill-in along a point-to-point sampling gap. That's something you'd want to discuss in a little more detail within your QAP. What does that actually mean? But if you've got data on both sides and no indication of anything in the middle, and you're just doing this as a feel-good, let's see what's there. I think you're in the clear there. And then what we talked about, when the rod says it's okay. So this is the Army Corps expectation, is if you're pursuing analog methodologies, that it's documented, it's screened in the feasibility study, and it's documented in the rod. So just two examples on either ends of the spectrum. I mean, we've got terrain. That's been a common exclusion before, but I think there's different methodologies to get different types of equipment there. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have vegetation restrictions and we simply cannot cut anything. And in those situations, you know, forcing AGC into 10% of the area really is no better and might even be worse than doing analog the best you can in those areas. So if those are the situations your sites are in, that's fine. Just documented, and that becomes part of the administrative record. And next slide, Amanda.
JJ, I'll put a caveat on that too. You know, we should hopefully outline that, you know, as we start, you know, as we're doing our site visits before the proposal, before, you know, we finalize that PWS, anything that we document and note on that, you know, if we can get in the PWS beforehand, that really helps everybody out.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And this is more of a summary slide, but all of these lessons learned have come from our projects recently. So I'm hoping we're doing a better job of documenting these issues as we move forward. The big one here to me is the first one. We want to ensure our PWS and the QAP draft worksheets we attach to that. We've walked through and discussed, how are we dealing with that selected remedy? How are we implementing that? And what's hidden behind there is, let's figure out sooner rather than later, did we say something dumb 10 years ago when we finalized this rod? Maybe we're in a situation that doing an ESD or a rod amendment at this stage is appropriate. So let's have those discussions. Let's get council involved at that stage and figure that out before we release the contract on the street, because that's a lot less painful than terminating the contract and starting all over again. And with that, I am done, Amanda. I think.
No, you still have one more.
Oh, no.
I mean, you can if you'd like to. I mean, neither of us could cover it. You know that. What about still more lessons learned? You've got that.
Oh, but yeah. I view these just as a summary of what we had talked already. So yeah, if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer. Otherwise, we can turn it to Amanda.
Chicken. Yeah, let's, Jeff, this is a good spot. If you have questions, let's get those now. And it looks like we do have a few as Jeff is popping over. So one of the questions is, what is SLAM? JJ.
Good question. SLAM is simultaneous location and mapping. So if you're familiar with GPS or robotic total station, you've got some sort of sensor on top of the instrument. SLAM would replace that, and it basically it produces a point cloud, and it knows where it is within that LIDAR point cloud. So it's an alternative positioning system that's been very useful in heavily vegetated areas.
I'm here, Amanda.
Thank
I got
you,
put
sir.
On double mute. Yeah,
no,
I got put
fine.
On double mute. All right, let's start off here. It may look good in a slide to say terrain is not a problem, but someone is going to be injured sooner or later. Terrain limitations should be clearly defined. All right.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that statement. I can put a nice pretty picture in there showing someone working really hard carrying that instrument, but I agree there's definitely the human element behind that as well. But again, I think your statement is clear and true. Terrain limitations should be clearly defined. And if for whatever reason we really are expecting digital in a tough to get to terrain situation, maybe we need to start thinking about engineering systems to help us collect that data. Obviously there's a cost. There's a production impact to that, and there's a cost impact to that. So we should be specifying that pretty clearly in those scenarios.
All right, next one. Where can we find data on depth of classification?
So there's a couple of different tools out there. I think at this point we now have enough projects under our belt that we can probably get you a general table of various munitions and what their depth of classification capabilities are for multiple instruments. But there are a few tools out there. There's some within pretty much every software package out there that you can use. And I think there's a standalone that may or may not still be supported, Detection Modeler.
All right, for site visits, what technology does the government recommend we use?
I'm sorry, Jeff, what was that one?
For site visits, what technology does the government recommend we use?
I'm going to assume,
yes,
Tom, that's going to be pre-proposal site or, you know, during the RFP site visit.
Yeah, I could take that question a number of different directions. So if we're talking the initial government stakeholder visit, I would hope the government has whatever tools they need to start answering some of these accessibility questions. And maybe it's not in that 1 hour site visit. Maybe they're seeing what the problem is and then they can come back and do whatever needs to be done. If we're talking about the RFP site visit, I know that can be difficult at times. You know, walking around with a Seanstat for 10 minutes may not give you the answer you need. A lot of our sites you can access on your own time, and maybe that's something you want to do. Some of our sites not, so that's something you'd probably want to coordinate with the Corps and the landowner in those situations. But I hope that as we move forward, the RIs start to get better and our pre-RFP GFIs start to get better, where the technology element of a site visit becomes less important.
All right, last one here, I think. Is analog acceptable for a surface clearance remedy, or is AGC expected for that as well?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I would expect those discussions to be had during the feasibility study. And as you start to discuss, what are we actually trying to implement and demonstrate? But as we've got quality control procedures that have been updated and revised over the last 7-ish years that I think, you know, an instrument aided surface clearance with those quality control procedures is probably adequate in most of our scenarios. But there may be a few scenarios out there where AGC is the right answer, where you're really just focused at what's on the surface. So I don't want to eliminate that, but it is something that should be discussed. Is this cost and appropriate for our site risks?
All right, I've got two more. Contractors are seeing removal action performance work statements that include removal requirements that far exceed the DDRAO. For example, the RAO lists two specific munitions to a depth of 24 inches, but the performance work statement says we need to remove all mech to depth of detection. Is the expansion in scope from what is identified in the DD allowed under CERCLA? Is the difference in cost included in the government cost estimate?
Yeah, so that is a bit more loaded of a question I'm comfortable answering, but there's some interesting statements in there that I would love to discuss offline because I think my answer to that is email me separately and we'll talk about the specifics behind that because that's a unique scenario.
All right. Will the performance work statement include the amount of terrain USACE has determined to be unsafe to collect AGC DGM data using a person collected mode? Right now, there are numerous performance work statements that do not include a number and direct the contractor to use only AGC.
So I think we're headed that direction where we're doing a better job of dictating or documenting where USACE has determined AGC is appropriate. I know there's still some out there and there might be sites where the expectation is 100% or very near 100%. So that might be where you'll continue to see some vague maximize AGC type statement, but I would expect those sites to be very limited in terms of data gap and just having a procedure for documenting what those actual data gaps might be is what's critical there, especially for proposal evaluation.
All right, next one, last one. It is technically incorrect to say that analog can reduce anomalies in an SRA if there isn't an audible break in the analog instrument from an explosive safety perspective. I recommend that slide be revised accordingly.
I think I get what the question's getting or the statement is getting at. So I agree. I can make that correction to that slide. I think there's different types of SRAs though. And so analog would apply in some of those while not in others. But yes, I agree with that clarification.
All right, that's the last question.
Fantastic discussion. Absolutely. So I know, Gene, we're scheduled to stop at 2:30, and I want to make sure that Jeff has time. Is that correct? 2:30 is our stop?
That is correct.
Thank you, ma'am. So I'm going to pick back up again, guys. Yay! But we are going to start looking at how SPP 1 and 2 feeds into the evaluation. And I love how Ryan set the stage for me to break all of this stuff down. But it is all a package deal, right? So, you know, when we're talking about GFI, putting all of that stuff out during the RFP, you know, we're looking at sending out the PWS, the RFP. We don't send out the evaluation worksheet, but we do have it ready for the source selection evaluation board. Of course, you know, we already have the MATOC that it's covered under, whether it is a MATOC or a SATOC. Then we're looking at, you know, all of our government furnished information on all of our deliverables. And as we've stressed throughout, you know, we've got our worksheets 10 and 11 and our notes captured on 9 and worksheet 9. But this is, you know, as Ryan talked about, this is one of the evaluation that we use the RFP. This is one of the more generic ones. So we look at the technical side of it. We're not going to focus on the price or, you know, the past performance, but just looking at the technical side, we're using the PWS to gauge the technical. So we want to see in the technical proposals that it's got sufficient detail, that it's broken down for the labor mix for each specific task, you know, for each clean. We're looking for that schedule. And then looking at the evaluation factors, you know, it breaks down, you know, we're looking at best value trade-off analysis, and I'll talk about a little bit about that in a minute. But then we're looking at the technical approach being the most important, so that when all the other non-price factors are combined, it is more significant than the price. The DOD in the FAR 15101-1 talks about, you know, the trade-off source selection process. And we use that best value continuum instead of the lowest price technically acceptable. So, you know, on the government aspect, you know, we can't award something other than the lowest price proposal or other than the highest technically rated proposal. You know, we're looking for that best value contract award, and all of that's outlined in that link below. And we look at it from a USA standpoint for MMRP work on a technical and a risk approach. So on the technical side, again, are we meeting or not the minimum performance and capability requirements through the technical approach, the risk, the management approach, the personnel qualifications, facilities, you know, all the other factors that go into it. And then on the risk, you know, have we outlined the risk, but then do the contractors have in their proposal ways to mitigate disruption of schedule, increased cost, degradation of performance? Have they decreased the need for government oversight? Or is there a likelihood of unsuccessful contract performance? And we evaluate all of that stuff unless I know some districts are writing their own evaluation criteria. But typically what we would like to do is just use that standard evaluation that you're seeing on the screen. And we gauge that against the PWS. So we're looking at all of those things and how it's meeting the intent of all of those things that we have outlined for our contract. So, you know, we want them to describe the technical approach that they're going to accomplish those project activities required. You know, each CLIN needs to be detailed and concise. There's no generic written information in there. We do want it broken down. And then how they're going to meet the objectives of those, the PWS. We want to know who. Don't just say, well, we're going to do it. Well, who do you have outlined for it? What equipment are you going to be using? John Jackson brought up the fact, you know, about all the variants of AGC stuff that we have right now. So what equipment are you going to be using? Do you own it? Do you rent it? What supplies are going to be required for it? Take us step by step through it. And then identify those risks and assumptions. And then do you have contingencies outlined? Your assumptions should be listed immediately. And I'm going to show you the risk management approach that we have outlined in the DAPM 38530. It's applicable whether you're looking at the pre-proposal part, you know, where the regulators and the USAs are working on identifying the hazards first and foremost, or if you're a contractor putting together your proposal, or if you're in the middle of a project, you know. So the first thing that you want to do is you want to identify your hazards or your risk, right? Anything that could slow the project down, derail it, be a safety concern, or, you know, be something that could hurt schedule. And then you want to assess the hazards. You want to make sure we're developing controls, making decisions. And then what plan do you have to implement those controls? So a really easy thing that I could see right here is, you know, I know we've all talked about it, but how about your biological concerns and your cultural concerns? Do you have your endangered species outlined? Stakeholders, you know, or regulators, have you all talked about things that would be required if X, Y, and Z? I can tell you on projects, butterflies have derailed a lot of people, as well as a salamander, the Cheat Mountain salamander, on a project. So make sure that you've identified it, you've assessed it, you know, do you have those controls in place? And now let's implement controls. And then last but not least, but let's supervise and evaluate. It's a continuous process throughout. Lessons learned on the award. And this is our last slide, so we can give Jeff the floor. But our outputs, worksheets 10, 11, and 9, are PWS. those outputs from SPP 1 and 2 are crucial that we get that to develop the PWS and set up the project for success. And we cannot do it without our regulators hand in hand with us, without that communication. We need those worksheets before award. And then we need to make sure that we identify critical issues before award to ensure our contractors can include it in their proposals, right? So it decreases their assumptions. It helps all of us out with risk, and then they can develop a more robust schedule. And I know hopefully some of you all have heard about the story, if you give a mouse a cookie, well, this is on the same concept. The better communication that we develop worksheets 10 and 11, the better the PWS is outlined. The better the PWS and worksheet 9 from SPP 1 and 2, the better the final QAP. The better the final QAP, the better the field work, the better the field work, the better the data analysis, and which results in a really happy team. So I want to leave the floor open because I know we have about 5 minutes for questions. But Jeff, do we have questions, sir?
No, we do not.
Wow. Awesome. So that's so, all I have. John Jackson, did you have anything else that you wanted to add?
Oh, wait, Amanda. Wait, one just came through. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Why is risk evaluation such a big evaluation factor on MATOC task orders? Haven't contractors been vetted as part of the MATOC award process? That is, the contractors have shown they know how to successfully execute MMRP work.
We can say that, but yet at the same time, we have project after project after project that we see that does have problems throughout. And it, I think it's part of the FAR that we have to do risk analysis every time. So great question, though.
All right. That was it.
Wow. Awesome. Just before the core stops, just want to thank everybody seriously just for your time and attention on this. I know the more that we can share and communicate with this, the better that we can all grow and improve our processes. So thanks.
All right. Great job, Amanda. Great job, John. And our next presenter is Jeff Swanson and from the state of Colorado. And it's all, the floor is yours, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. Jeff Swanson from Colorado. As with Ryan, I've been engaged in MMRP work for more than 20 years. Today, I'm going to give kind of a regulatory perspective on the whole contracting and SPP process. But I'm going to look at it really from, to me, regulatory engagement in contracting and SPP is, it's all about regulatory engagement. And let's see if I can move these slides correctly. We can go back 20 years and more. Regulatory engagement has been a challenge and an issue from the beginning of MMRP work. Early on, DOD was extremely reluctant to engage regulators before they had contracts. So they would show up with the contractor and the scope before they ever started talking to the regulatory agencies about what their expectations were, level of involvement, any of those kind of things. Good news is that we've seen significant improvements in that through the years, and significantly in the last several years with the QAP toolkit and the processes set there. We've also seen huge improvements in regulatory engagement and in being able to be part of the process for data quality. And the QAP toolkit and accreditation have really been game changers in terms of defining regulatory roles and stakeholder roles and ensuring our participation in the process, and I think improving the process. So what do I mean when I say regulatory engagement? It's really involvement throughout the entire life cycle of the project. And we're engaged from site identification and the initial preliminary assessment and that part all the way through to remedy selection, execution, and site closeout. Specific to remedial investigations, or I wrote this slide to remedial action, we're really engaged in more than just that strategic planning process meetings. A lot of contractors have come in assuming that we're going to have four formal meetings and we're going to talk and we're going to fill out worksheets, and that's regulatory engagement. It's much more than that. I put this slide together to identify some of the kind of key points that I think about in terms of engagement through the process, from scoping to design to execution to reporting on those projects. A lot of the focus today has been on that those engagement opportunities in scoping. And I think that when those are done well, they make for significantly better contracts and significantly better projects. But it doesn't stop there. It's also critical to have regulatory buy-in on those final data quality objectives, the verification and validation plans. How are those going to be implemented? When are people going to see them? Who's going to make decisions based on them? Making sure that everybody's bought into all of those objectives for MPCs, MQOs, SOPs, the whole alphabet there. That's important to getting that QAP put together. Another major point of that QAP is worksheet 6 and what's your communication strategy. Regular communication through the whole project team can significantly increase the success of these projects. With that, it's keeping people apprised of the progress. When you reach decision points, it's making sure that everyone's engaged in those major decision points and you get the proper buy-in, whatever synonym you want to use for buy-in within your project, making sure that data and information is shared and is flowing throughout the whole team. And at the end, making sure that data usability assessments are completed and everybody buys into those results, addressing any issues that might come up and making sure that everyone's on the same page with the conclusions and results of the project. In remedial action, that becomes extremely important if your site is looking to get to UUE or some type of unrestricted use, which is going to require that extra level of buy-in from everybody. So we haven't really talked about it yet, but one of the stakeholders mentioned in all of this is, or one of the TPP product delivery team members identified in a lot of this, are your local stakeholders. By that, I mean local government and landowners. Those people can be one of your most valuable assets on a site, or quite frankly, they can be one of your biggest pain in the asses. A lot of times it depends on how you've engaged them, or more specifically, who has engaged them in the past and how those people have engaged them. So it might take some extra effort in building some bridges and reestablishing those communications. But that local knowledge can be invaluable to a project. In terms of things like site access, not just is it steep slopes, but where are the gates? Where are the roads? What type of equipment can go on any of those gates or roads? Are you going to be allowed to have equipment offsite or off of those roads, or are you going to be walking? Those types of questions, quite frankly, come down to the landowner. If those people aren't engaged before the contract, there's going to be some big disconnects. Making sure that the community and the landowners are aware of what the impacts of this project are going to be. I think John Jackson mentioned an example of clear cutting trees versus selectively cutting and having plans for how to address trees on a site. Those types of engagements with the stakeholders, with the landowners early on, can make a project run smoothly. If that's not done, you might be dead in the water. With those impacts come restoration. What types of restoration is expected? How will that restoration be conducted? When will it be conducted? Getting all of those types of issues worked out, quite frankly, before the contract is ever awarded, so that they can be taken into account within the scoping of that contract. I think at the bottom line there is, it's the landowner's land. It's the local community. They're the ones that are going to be impacted by this project. They're the ones who have been impacted by these sites. We're just visiting. We need to figure out how to go in, get our jobs done, minimizing those impacts and fully engaging those people. One of the questions earlier was about community involvement. When do you engage the local government and landowners? My answer to that is you should be doing it now. That engagement should have occurred long before a remedial investigation or a remedial action. If it hasn't, you're going to be behind the eight ball, and you're going to have to do some extra efforts to get that engagement up to the level it needs to be. But it needs to be early in the planning process, to ensure any of those local requirements are addressed, and avoid any surprises later on in the project. So a big step forward that I've seen with the Army Corps, and I can't emphasize it enough, is the membership of the project delivery team. John mentioned it several times in his talk. The project delivery team includes your regulators and your local stakeholders. In the past, there's been some confusion over that, and there's been some miscommunications and some issues based on that. But it's good to have that move forward to the acknowledgement that, yes, your regulatory agencies and your local community stakeholders are part of that team. So within that team, how much coordination is really enough? Most of these contracts are going to identify the four main SPP meetings as part of the QAP process. Those are going to be in the contract. Those are great, but that's just the beginning. The QAP also needs to be identifying where those critical decision points are and where that, how that project delivery team is going to come together to evaluate and make those decisions. Your project will probably have community involvement forums. Those should be in a community outreach plan. If there isn't a community outreach plan yet, any remedial action should have one, and any RIFS should have one. You'll also want to have regular project update calls, keeping everybody informed throughout the project. That's especially critical if it's going to be a long, large project, to keep everybody engaged, keep everybody on the same page, keep everyone reminded of what's going on, identify any types of issues. I like to have monthly calls on my projects. That's certainly not a requirement, but when you're scoping these projects and you're having these first SPP meetings, it's a great conversation to have. How are we going to keep everybody engaged? How many regular project meetings should we have? Should we be doing these monthly or quarterly? The same thing with field reporting. It's usually a natural progression when people are in the field to have daily and then weekly summaries of the dailies. Who are those distributed to? Does it go to the whole project delivery team? If not, why not? Is it because somebody opted out? But making sure that you've got that information out there and everybody's sharing it. Why is all of that important? That's all important because in a lot of cases, when your project identifies issues with an MTO, hopefully not an MPC, and there's something that needs to be addressed with that, you've got your project delivery team up to speed, everybody's on the same page, and you can fairly quickly engage them in, this is the issue that's coming up, this is the MPC that we're having problems with. You can go through any root cause analysis and any corrective action that might be done, need to be done, or any field change requests that need to be done. And you can do those engaging in a meeting and hopefully not have a large project disruption. If you send those things to your regulator cold, he's probably going to take several days to digest that information. There's going to be calls back and forth to clarify the information. And it could go on for a long time. That's a big project risk that can be easily avoided. How much coordination is too much? That's rarely been an issue, but there are stakeholders that may choose not to be engaged as often as others on the project delivery team. That's good. It just needs to be their choice. As part of that scoping, you want to have that conversation with the local government and the landowner of how engaged do you want to be? Here are the different channels we can use to communicate with you. Which ones would you like and how regular do you want to be part of that? That eliminates confusion. It makes everybody feel like they're engaged at the level they want to be and that they're not excluded. You start excluding people from information and you start building untrust, mistrust, and then you get conspiracy theories, and that can go sideways really quickly. So now I'm going through this presentation, I thought about what are the positive, what works well, what have I seen in projects throughout the years that have been successful? I think for a project delivery team, first and foremost, it comes up to leadership and commitment and trust. It's that core RPM and their commitment to both the projects and to the team, establishing effective communications and trusting each other that information is going to be shared accurately and freely. It's also clearly defining everyone's roles and expectations. It's making sure, from my perspective, that you know that if it's a critical issue, it's going to be something that I should be able to look at in weeks. If it's a routine review, it might be several weeks or a month, but making sure that those expectations are out there and everybody knows them. And it's keeping everyone fully engaged throughout the project, even if the project is delayed, even if you're just calling to say, hey, the contractor is delayed in getting this to us. It's keeping everyone informed so everybody's aware. An important piece to keep in mind and something that I think can't be stressed enough is there are critical steps in every project that you want formal buy-off. You want to memorialize those decisions. You want everybody to make sure that they are in agreement. Silence is not always agreement. So make sure that you take the proactive step of getting that formal buy-off. I use the word buy-off because I think that's a generic term that you can insert whatever other adjective you want to describe that agreement or concurrence or sign off or whatever your team wants to do. For the actual SBP meetings, having the right people there and engaged, it works both ways. I've had SBP meetings that I was not prepared for and went in with very little knowledge of what was going on. But I've also had core project managers do the same. Those are very ineffective meetings. You don't get a lot done. Make sure everybody knows what the goals and expectations of the meeting are. Keep an open dialogue and write down the answer. Make sure that you fill out that worksheet 9 and circulate it to get everybody's buy-off on it. I'll also say that that's part of the trust building process. And don't shortcut that process. Don't try to do all of the conceptual site model and go through all of the data quality objectives in a quick meeting. Take the time to discuss all of those issues and make sure that everybody has an understanding of the project and what the goals are and what we're trying to accomplish. So what doesn't work? Nobody wants to feel like they're a second tier member of a team. Putting your regulators and stakeholders in a separate box and selectively sending them information, excluding them from critical discussions and just telling them what the decision is, that's going to build distrust, and that's going to cause your regulators to want to look much harder at what's going on and frustrations that go against the whole concept of working as a team. Segregated communication channels. This has been an issue that I had with one of the services where the Air Force contracts with the Corps to do their MMRP work. The Corps PM contracts with one of the munitions contractors, and that contractor has multiple subs. My conversations are with the Air Force PM, and by the time that information trickles down to that contractor and their subs, who knows what they're hearing? Those types of segregations in communication and establishing those formal chain of command, it could be important if it's a contracting decision or it's directing the contractor, but for day-to-day operations and for communication within the project delivery team, segregating those communications, in my mind, doesn't work, and it just leads to miscommunication and all of the perils of that. Not involving the project team, the full team, in planning or decision-making. There's nothing worse than having a meeting where you show up and your core project manager tells you what the decision is and what the answer is, and you're expected to nod and go on with it, and realizing that everybody's on a different page, that in some cases there's not even agreement as to what the question or decision is, let alone the answer. And with that, limiting the regulatory communication to just SPP meetings it's a precursor to those types of problems. Specifically with TPP meetings, I've found that we're getting better at this, but early on, some contractors confused the SPP meetings with public information sessions and would attempt to do those concurrently. Contractors who look at a TPP, an SPP meeting as we have 4 of them required, so I'm going to check the box 4 times. Thank you very much. having meetings and having critical issues raised and not reaching agreements, trying to kick the can down the road, that can's just going to get bigger and the risk is going to grow. And again, failure to engage the local government or landowners and failure to address their concerns. So we talked about the good and the bad. And as Clint Eastwood would say, what about the ugly? So I put together some lessons learned and just some things to think about kind of down in the details as you're going through these meetings and working these issues and just some of the things I've come across. The cultural natural resources trap, I think it's good that John really brought this up during the course presentation as something to look out for in terms of what's the scope of effort for addressing cultural natural resources on project sites. I think that needs to be even pushed back further into the initial scoping of what's the process for agreeing to between the landowner, the local government, and the Army Corps on what requirements are in place for both surveying a site to determine if there are any cultural, natural resource, threatened endangered species, protected habitat issues, and what the requirements are for mitigating those impacts, and who are the decision makers in terms of deciding what those appropriate mitigation requirements are. I've had in the last couple of years two large major projects dead in the water because the Corps contractor and the local landowner were on two different pages in terms of what level of surveys and what level of mitigation might be, not even mitigation, we didn't even get to mitigation, just what level of surveys would be required to assess the site at the beginning of the project. So those are critical to get identified in the scoping of the project and addressed in the contract. The other question is, what does it mean to be inaccessible? I've had a lot of contractors who want to put a number to it, say a slope of 40% is inaccessible, and write that in. And one even went to the effort of having a professional land surveyor survey in their grids and identify which grids were 30% or higher. In that case, we went up and looked at the site and we walked right through the middle of these 30% grids and it was clearly accessible. Those numbers can be a trap, whether it's 30% or 40%. I'm looking at it more in terms of actually going out in the field and identifying this is an area that is inaccessible because it has steep slopes or because the vegetation or terrain features or whatever. The other consideration in accessibility is allowable access. Obviously, it's a significantly different project if you've got a road going through the site that you can use versus you've got to have off-road vehicles and what types of vehicles versus the landowner who says no vehicles of any type can go across this land. Vegetation as a barrier and vegetation removal. For most sites, I've seen if we can get out on the site with the landowner and the decision maker for that landowner and talk through, this is the vegetation, these are the trade-offs in removing that vegetation versus leaving that vegetation, we can come up with an acceptable approach to addressing that vegetation. That's much easier to do before, during the scoping part, so that that can be put into the RFP and people can bid on that, versus contractors coming in with their own assumptions that might be different from the landowners, and ending up having to do contract mods, or in an extreme situation, not even be able to contract the project. John also talked about his quality assurance surveillance plan under the contract versus the quality assurance under the QAP with seeding plans and verification validation plans. All I can say is, seriously, I've had contractors who thought that their quality assurance surveillance plan with their contracting officer representative checked the box for QA on their remediation projects. I think with the education and with the new QAP stuff coming out, that should no longer be an issue. But surprisingly, it continues to be. The last one I have, and then I'll open up for questions, is a complete breakdown in communications. We actually had a project where the project delivery team was not communicating, and the QAP was not signed off on before field work started. Somehow that communication was so bad that the contractor and their field team wasn't aware that there were still issues being resolved under the QAP, and went out and executed the work somehow within that field team. There were no checks and balances to actually verify that they had a approved QAP before they went in the field. So my lesson learned from that is that all of this communication really is critical to making these projects work. And when communication breaks, you can never predict how far down the road that crash is going to occur, or what the consequences might be. So with that, I'm going to open it up to questions.
All right, Jeff, thank you very much. We're running just a little short on time here, so we may not get to everybody's questions. So I'm going to whip these off real quick. Can you talk about virtual space meetings? We are getting pressure to do these virtually for ease in scheduling and reduced travel cost. Other stakeholders are insistent that these meetings can be only done if held in person, where all parties can focus solely on the meetings, and they are addressing SPP meetings, not space meetings.
Personally, I've done both SPP meetings in person and virtually. I strongly encourage in-person meetings for especially those, the second meeting with the Army Corps, where you're sitting down and really going over the scope and filling out worksheet 11, and that first meeting with the contractor where you're revisiting the scoping and getting everything going on the right foot. The times that we've done it virtually, it's difficult to judge how engaged everybody is, and it's easy for everyone to just kind of check the box and move on. And that's where issues get kicked down the road to just cause bigger problems. So you can do both, but I would suggest you make the commitment to in-person, or at least those most critical ones.
All right, last question. Should regulators and stakeholders be the authority on future land use, or is some data-driven exercise to determine future land use by the PDT during the SPP process preferred?
Regulators don't make land use decisions. Land use decisions are up to the landowner and the local government. You can make land use assumptions, and sometimes those assumptions are better than others. But the landowner and the local government are the ones who make land use decisions. What we have to make sure we do when we do these cleanups is either make it protective of those potential future land uses, and we can clean up to reasonably anticipated future land use, but we still have to make sure that when we address reasonably anticipated land use, that we also put the controls in place so that if our assumptions are wrong, that we can go back and correct them and ensure that the cleanup is still protected.
Great.
A lot of words there.
Thank you. That was the last question. We are out of time. Thank you all, instructors, John, Ryan, Amanda, Jeff. And I'm going to run this to Gene real quick. And just don't forget one last thing, guys, for me. The next webinar will be on June 28th. So be looking for that. I'll have the invites out a little bit later.
All right. Thank you so very much, Jeff. Let me go ahead and pull up our closing materials, and we'll walk through those very important final reminders and close out our session today. I do want to thank you, thank all of our participants. There were almost 200 of you who joined us for today's live session, as well as our presenters and organizers who helped put on today's broadcast. I'll remind everyone, we encourage you to connect with us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org. We do have a number of regular information resources, such as monthly newsletters like Tech Direct that go out, as well as podcasts and RSS feeds. So I encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, if you'd like to learn about the latest upcoming internet seminars like today's session. I will also point you back to that seminar homepage. So if you weren't here at the beginning when I covered that, today's session does have a unique URL. It's shown in red on the following slide. That website will be archived from today forward. So you can visit that page. And on that page, there's a sample of one of these seminar homepages shown on the slide. There are sections which contain information, including info on our speakers, links to download their presentations, as well as related links and references that have been pulled together by our presenters. So if you'd like a copy or like to browse through some of those materials, perhaps find some of the templates and links that were discussed in our session today, I encourage you to visit that website. If you happen to be one of the lucky people watching the recording, version, that page is still open, so you can still go to the URL shown in red at the top of the slide to access these resources. One quick tip, you may want to use those links that appear on the far right that allow you to expand and collapse the various sections. So it might be easier to expand or collapse or scroll all the way down till you find the right part of the content. Notably, there is a link to our feedback form, and I point that out because those of you who are looking for a participation certificate need to fill out that online feedback form for today's session. So visit the seminar homepage, scroll down to the feedback form, and complete the feedback form. Make sure you check the box at the bottom that certifies you were here for the entire session. And as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll then have immediate access to a participation certificate that looks something like this one. And you'll be able to download that or print it out for your own records. We will email a copy of that certificate too, but sometimes it gets caught up by junk and spam filters. So I encourage you to download it or print it right from the confirmation page. If you happen to be joined with a number of other people at your location, please send the link to the seminar homepage to those who gathered at your location to view the session. Each person can fill out that feedback form, even if they didn't register on their own, and still get a participation certificate for their own records. And then, of course, if you're one of the lucky people watching the recorded version of today's session, you can still visit that seminar homepage, again, shown in red at the top of the slide, fill out the feedback form, making sure you check the box that you replayed the entire session, and you can download or save a participation certificate based off of your replay. Usually takes me about 1 week to post an archive. I'll automatically send an email as soon as the recording from today's session is available for on-demand playback. And with that, I have completed my final reminders. I hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and you'll join us on a future Cluin seminar. Thanks so very much for joining us.